Greetings, I'm Fred Zaspel. Welcome to another author interview here at Books at a Glance. Today we're talking to Madison Trammell about his book, Fundamentalists in the Public Square: Evolution, Alcohol, and Culture Wars After the Scopes Trial. Trammell, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's an honor to be here and to get to talk about my book. It's great to meet you too.
Yeah, it's your first time with us. Introduce yourself. Tell us where you are, what you do, and all of that.
Yes, I live in Southern California, but I work at Lifeway, where I serve as publisher of B&H Academic. And this book grew out of PhD research I did while I was attending Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary under Jason Dusing's leadership.
All right, good. All right, first off, let's define our terms and sharpen our focus a bit. Fundamentalist, that's a term with a range of meanings today, particularly negative connotations today. So what do we mean by Christian fundamentalism? Are we speaking of Baptist fundamentalism or what? Give us a brief snapshot of the history and tell us exactly the focus of your book.
There are a few different ways to look at fundamentalism. In its most broad usage, people will use it to refer to a strict follower of any religion. There are others like Ernest Sandin, the historian, who traces like a fundamentalist impulse throughout Protestant history as just kind of a way of being Protestant that has always been there. But I
Kind of
didn't
a
have any of those.
spirit.
Yeah, like a spirit, kind of a posture. I didn't have either of those things in mind. So for me, I was looking at evangelical history and treating fundamentalism as a chapter in evangelical history. So briefly, if you'd like me to summarize who I have
Yes.
in mind. Yeah, so starting with, I'm looking at evangelical history the way that it often is categorized. So starting with the Great Awakening, Whitfield and Edwards and Wesley, people like that launch it. And then during the Second Great Awakening, it's reshaped by populism and evangelistic methods. Then during the mid-19th century, it reaches its zenith. It's very influential in the US. But by the end of the 19th century, it starts to come into conflict with theological modernism, and fundamentalism is a response to that. So you have the fundamentalist modernist controversy that starts kind of at the very end of the 19th century, but really the beginning of the 20th century. And that will continue until neo-evangelicalism reemerges after World War II with Billy Graham and other leaders of his generation.
Yeah, that segment of what fundamentalism is actually my background as well. All right, the general consensus concerning fundamentalism is that it was rather isolationist. It's concerned for evangelism, but it was not very concerned to get involved in broader social issues, matters of public policy. So, first of all, is there any sense in which that consensus is correct? And then, what is there about that consensus that you're wanting to correct? Just briefly here, and we'll get into some of the specifics in a minute.
Yes, I think that consensus becomes more true as fundamentalism goes on. But at the very beginning, in the era that I'm looking at, it's not true. Fundamentalists are still pretty engaged on public issues, and they're quoted in newspapers. They have some key leaders that are often referred to, like in the public square, for different issues. And not that I can give you anyone a perfect picture just from newspapers, but there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm for a certain couple of key social issues. So I would say at this time period, they weren't focused solely on evangelism. They always were focused on evangelism, but also they cared about influencing the culture as much as they could. They will not be successful in their main aims. And I think, and this part is partly conjecture on my part because I looked mostly at the beginning of the interwar era. But as you go on, I think they get more marginalized and they start to focus more on spiritual matters solely. And if there are denominations today that are fundamentalists, they're probably more focused on evangelism and spiritual work than in political work, say. But at the time that I looked at, that hadn't really come about yet.
I'll get into some of your specifics in a second from your book, but first of all, still kind of broadly, was this era of fundamentalism much involved politically on the American scene?
They were sometimes. There were certain pastors who have a paragraph in the book. I can't remember exactly how it went, but there are a few pastors that were doing circuits, going to each other's churches, well-known pastors who were also fundamentalist leaders. And they were speaking out for Smith, a candidate Smith in 1928, who lost the election to Roosevelt, but who they were hoping would win because he was a dry candidate. So there was it was very clearly political and on a
Interesting.
national scale.
Interesting. Okay, let's take up some of the topics. Talk to us first of all about fundamentalism and evolution. Now you're talking post-Scopes trial, but evidently so this is still involved in the public scene.
Right. The argument I wanted to make was that fundamentalists didn't withdraw after the Scopes trial, because if you read Fundamentalism in American Culture by George Marston, which is an excellent book in almost every respect, but he has a comment in there that fundamentalists began to withdraw because the Scopes trial was a public embarrassment. So then they focused on their own institutions and their own work and sort of retreated from the public square because they weren't welcome there and they had been shamed publicly, is essentially his argument. And I wanted to see if that was true. And I felt like it almost, that just couldn't be the case that they would withdraw so suddenly. So that's what I was looking at, especially in newspapers. And what I found is on evolution, they advocate very loudly for public schools not to teach evolution. Evolution's already been around for a while, of course, but public schools are starting to standardize what they teach. And so it's becoming the kind of thing where your kids now in any community across the country are running into evolution in the books that they read. So they were concerned about that and were organizing against it. The law was on their side in the Scopes trial. It was illegal to teach evolution in the public school. So they won the trial as expected. But beyond that, they go on after the trial, and there are articles about movements and organizations where they're trying to like duplicate this victory around the country and even around the world, like going to other countries and also enforcing this opposition to evolution. And it's such a strong identification that I felt like by a certain point in the newspaper reporting, the word fundamentalist also almost means anti-evolutionist. And when the writer is talking about a fundamentalist, what they actually mean is an anti-evolutionist and not all their other theological commitments. That's like those two terms are almost synonymous.
Interesting. Interesting. Were the fundamentalists actually ashamed after the Scopes trial?
I
Did
didn't
they
see
feel an embarrassment?
Any evidence of that.
Yeah, I never knew of any of that. Okay, good. All right, you mentioned the matter of alcohol just briefly earlier. So let's talk about that. Fundamentalists and the issue of drinking and not.
Right. So they are firm supporters of prohibition. The prohibition coalition is much broader than the one against evolution. So it was never just them. This is the kind of issue where, like, the Christian Century, the more liberal Protestant magazine, would also be for prohibition. So there are a lot of different Christian Protestant groups that can make common cause on this issue. And it had been a longer running issue, too. You could find evidence of like the early push towards some kind of prohibition or limiting of alcohol from almost the very beginning of US history. Way, way back when, you'll find sermons, early 1800s, pushing
Interesting. I
alcohol.
didn't know that.
So it's a long running movement. It's much more successful than the anti-evolution crusade in the sense that an amendment is passed and it becomes a law of the land that alcohol can't be sold. So they're firm supporters all the way through. And even after prohibition is overturned, you'll still find some fundamentalist leaders talking about how alcohol should still be illegal. So they're firmly committed to it, but they're never alone in it. They have other allies. So I feel like they weren't as identified singularly with prohibition in newspapers, but you can see them everywhere if you're looking for them.
Yeah, well, my sense is, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but the era, the atmosphere of the whole thing, it was not just for them a biblical issue. It was a wide social issue because of the ills that were tied to it. Is that right?
Yes, that's definitely true. If you read a sermon, it's a little early for the fundamentalist era, but like Billy Sunday, preaching against alcohol, he lists so many reasons why alcohol ought to be illegal, and maybe 90% are just social cultural reasons.
Yeah,
It's money, we don't want to spend money on jails and insane asylums. It's bad for
okay.
families. A lot of practical reasons.
Yeah, I think one of the big ones was and this is why women were so involved in it, isn't that right? Is because so many men were drunk and irresponsible fathers and
Yeah, contributing to family and social breakdown. Men are off carousing, they're being good fathers.
All right. Did any of this whether the evolution or the alcohol issue, did any of it serve to marginalize fundamentalism in the eyes of the public?
It did with some. So there are people like H.L. Mencken who are very acidic in criticizing them. And there's a definite sense that the learned college leader type person in the US at the time is not going to be on their side. So they weren't maybe welcome in those sort of thought leader circles. But at a common level, I think
That
it was
wait about that was nothing new though, was it?
right. And that's not new. That's been
Yeah,
going
right.
on for a while already. This is just a presenting issue, evolution. But among the like general public, I didn't get the sense that they were marginalized. Newspapers expect them to be against evolution, and they're afforded some respect for it too. Like this religious people are good
Interesting.
people. They're part of the
Interesting.
foundation of society, and it's natural they might think this way about evolution. So they weren't, the tone of newspaper reporting wasn't altogether negative. Certain circles were almost always negative, but not everyone.
Yeah, okay. All right, fundamentalism and fundamentalist social action and dispensational theology. What's the connection?
So almost all of the leaders that I looked at are dispensationalists, either actively or they're influenced by dispensationalism. So like some of them, they may not talk about Israel a lot. So they wouldn't like compare dispensational and covenant theology, say, or Israel's role, but they're still going to hold dispensational views on prophecy or be interested in prophecy in a way that we would say is clearly dispensational today. And what I found is that the social action of fundamentalists was partly consistent with dispensational theology and partly not. So what they believed about the Bible, they were consistent with. The way they looked at sin, they were consistent with. But they weren't consistent in their anthropology or their ecclesiology or their eschatology. In sum, they acted in their social action as if people who were not believers could do better things than they really thought they were capable of theologically, and if society could be redeemed further than they really believed was possible theologically. And they also gave the church a role for impacting culture that you just won't see if you read a fundamentalist theologian like Lewis Sperry Schaeffer. Like his role for the church and the role they were actually filling in pursuing aims of social good don't align.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, did fundamentalism have a well thought out view of cultural engagement, or is this something that just happened because of cultural reasons or what?
I never found anything explicit where anyone stated a theology of cultural engagement. So it seemed more like a natural response for them that they wanted America to be heading in a better direction. They wanted to protect what they thought was good about America, and they just started doing it. So as I was trying to develop what I would say is their sort of de facto theology of cultural engagement, it was very much just pieced from little bits of what they said and did, but nothing like coherent
Yeah.
and fully thought through.
So a given issue of the day called for action and they jumped in. But
Yeah.
yeah, okay.
Yeah. Just
Yeah.
like Bevington's sort of activist impulse that he talks about for
Yeah.
evangelicals. And that.
Yeah. Right. Okay. What light does all this shed on Carl Henry's critique of fundamentalism in his book, The Uneasy Conscience of Fundamentalism? Anything on that?
Right. So Henry says that fundamentalists lack a social vision. But historians like Matthew Avery Sutton have said that he does bad history. But he outright said that in one of his volumes. Carl Henry did bad history. So I wouldn't go quite that far. That's not gracious to Henry. But I think my take on it is that he was overstating a bit. He's using rhetoric to make a point. And what he really wanted was for fundamentalists to become more engaged because they had started to retreat by the end of the, not retreat, but like be pushed to the edges and not try to gain ground back by the end of the interwar period. And I think he also wanted them to broaden their concerns. So Henry, even though he's generally conservative, if you read his columns in Christianity Today in later years, he still has a broader view of what he thinks fundamentalists should be doing in politics, where it's like you're contributing to the common good. And you're trying to address every single issue across the board, and what we might call do culture making, like creating arts,
Right.
creating fine literature, all of that. It's all kind of put together for him. So he has a broader vision that I think he's trying to call fundamentalist too.
So he had an agenda.
I think that's fair to say. That's not
Okay. All right. All right. Talk to us about the sources that you used on this. Were there primary sources that that stood out, or a main genre of sources, newspapers and whatnot? And then also with that, what surprises did you find? What came up that was a particular interest?
So I looked at newspapers in four states from 1920 to 1933. And the four states I chose were New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Ohio, which were the four largest at the time. None of them are southern states, so they're not Tennessee or right next to Tennessee. So I thought that would be interesting for my purposes since I'm looking at the Scopes trial and its aftermath. And just read every article I could find in that time period that had to do with prohibition or evolution. There's a new tool out there called newspaperarchive.com, or new as in the past 15
Yes,
years.
I've used that.
Yeah. So it's really helpful. I wouldn't have even attempted something like this 20 years ago. But with that database, you're actually able to do a pretty good search. Not that you catch everything, but you catch a lot in those years. So I read dozens of articles and just tried to develop a snapshot of their public profile and what they engaged on, fundamentalists, during these years. Now, the surprises, there were a few. Some were fun, some not so fun. One, some of the critics of fundamentalism were actually entertaining to read. So I wasn't finding myself agreeing with them, but H.L. Mencken and Clarence Darrow are both really clever. So if you read them, they're funny. They're not always fair at all, but they land a lot of zingers and they're good with words.
Okay, good. All right, give us, before we close off, give us a brief overview of your book so that everybody can know what it's all about and how you progress.
Yeah, thank you. So the book is an argument in favor or trying to demonstrate that fundamentalists do engage in cultural debate, especially about evolution and prohibition in the interwar period after the Scopes trial, just to show that they did it at all, sort of corrects as a, like a corrective to the record of what we've previously believed about evangelicals. And I also thought it was just, like I said, fun to read a bunch of newspapers. And you get this very different picture for fundamentalists of the period than you get from their own like theological writings or church ministry type writings.
Great. All right. We're talking to Madison Trammell about his book, Fundamentalists in the Public Square: Evolution, Alcohol, and Culture Wars After the Scopes Trial. Great to have you with us, Madison. It was a fascinating study. We encourage everyone to get a copy. This is a fascinating moment in history. I'm glad you've written on it. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's great to be here with you today.